Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In his third State of the State address, Governor Gavin Newsom went through a laundry list of talking points. Some of the bigger issues the governor talked about were the rising gas prices we've all been experiencing and homelessness. He also talked about the California way. That was the catchphrase the governor used every time he made a point to mention how he's handled various aspects of the job. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon was at the address in person yesterday and joins us now with the highlights. Nicole, welcome back to Insight.
Glad to be here.
This year was a stark contrast to last year at Dodger Stadium, and you were there in person. What were the biggest differences?
I mean, yeah, these were two very different speeches. In LA at Dodger Stadium last year, the governor did not have an in-person audience at all. He was talking to this, you know, quote unquote crowd of about 55,000 empty seats. That was symbolic of the losses of the pandemic, but it was also, you know, a symbol of the way forward. That baseball stadium was serving as a mass vaccination site at that time when more people were just becoming eligible for the vaccine. Last night, he was at a new state office building in Sacramento, not the legislature where the speech is traditionally held. But it was the same space where Newsom presented his January budget proposal. And I also went to that same building, but a very different feel from 2 months ago. In January, as you know, we were coming off the Omicron surge. Everybody was rapid tested. There were very few people in the room. Social distancing, you were like 5 or 6 seats away from the nearest person. They required high quality masks. Last night, everyone was rapid tested, but there were very few masks in the room. A lot of people, statewide elected officials, lawmakers, journalists, and people were mingling and sitting right next to each other, mostly maskless.
The governor repeatedly used the phrase, the California way. What was the intention of that?
This is something the governor has talked about many times, and it's that, or at least hinted to, and that's that, you know, California can be an example to the rest of the country, that, you know, the state often leads on big problems like climate change, which is an example he talked about. And he mentioned that, you know, at this time when there's a lot of uncertainty in the world, people are focused on what's happening overseas in Ukraine. The state can be of an example of sort of coming together and solving these big sort of intractable problems. However, if you ask Republicans and others in the state about that, they might disagree. But it's something that the governor has talked about several times.
Well, Nicole, in light of Ukraine, the governor spoke, or the length of the speech was relatively short. It lasted just under 18 minutes. And he started off by admitting, given the state of the world, he didn't imagine many people outside of state government were eagerly awaiting what he was going to say. I mean, that's a pretty underwhelming setup. Did that surprise you?
The length of the speech was a bit surprising. You know, I feel like I've heard the governor talk off script at press conferences for more than 20 minutes before, or maybe I guess it just feels like that. But I think he does understand that most people around the state aren't tuning into these speeches. I do think, you know, he had it in the evening. That probably was an attempt to reach more people as they were just getting home. I know several TV stations in the area had it live, or as they were commuting home, we had it live on this station. But for Newsom, these speeches in recent years have been, you know, ways to tout what he and what the state are doing. And he did that last night. Not a lot of new policy proposals. He spent most of this short speech talking about things that he's already passed or some newer proposals he's come up with. He talked about this care court plan he unveiled last week, which is meant to get severely mentally ill people experiencing homelessness into treatment. He spent quite a bit of time, you know, talking about the huge surplus and all the things that it went toward, stimulus checks, more education programs and things like that.
Yeah. The juggernaut elephant in the room right now was arguably gas. It is $5.57 a gallon in California. That's 13 cents higher than yesterday. The governor discussed some kind of relief for drivers. Let's take a listen.
Look, no one's naive about the moment we're living in, with high gas prices and the geopolitical uncertainty that's fueling them. In January, we proposed a pause to the gas tax increase. Now, it's clear we have to go farther. And that's why, working with legislative leadership, I'll be submitting a proposal to put money back in the pockets of Californians to address rising gas prices.
All right, Nicole, he didn't really give much detail or even so much a timeline. What did Republicans have to say about this?
Well, we heard from several Republicans that, you know, in general, something they're used to from Governor Newsom is flashy announcements without a lot of details. And we talked to Assemblymember Heath Flora right after the speech. He's a Republican from San Joaquin County. And he said this tax relief the governor brought up last night is a good example of that. Let's listen.
Actually, that's where it lacks substance. I actually don't know what that means. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that develops and what he's actually talking about there. When it comes back to putting money back into our constituents' pockets, especially when the state has the largest budget with the largest surplus that we've had in a very long time, well, ever, I think that's important.
Well, Nicole, I guess for people who are really interested in gas prices, which is a lot of people across the state, how could this happen? How would they realistically get money back in their pockets?
It's something that, you know, it wasn't totally clear from the governor's speech last night. We did get a little clarification from his press office that it wouldn't be they don't want to change necessarily. They don't want to do a gas tax holiday. They're open to still pausing the increase in July, but it sounds like they're talking about a tax rebate for drivers as soon as May. It sounds like they might, you know, be trying to do this tax year as people are filing their taxes right now.
Yeah, May sounds kind of far away for people that are dealing with record gas prices. And in some places across the state, it's already encroaching or it's already past $6 a gallon. How does all of this fit into California's climate and environmental goals? Democrats have been trying to move the state away from fossil fuels. So how do these high fuel prices factor into this?
Well, it definitely puts Democrats in a tough spot because the cost of living is already very high in California. Inflation is hitting people. You know, we've heard on this show that when the cost of daily essentials like food and gas go up, it hurts low-income people the most. And that's exactly what Newsom and Democrats say they don't want and they're trying to fight against. But at the same time, you know, the governor wants to encourage people to move away from gas-powered vehicles. He signed an executive order a couple of years ago outlawing sales of new gas-powered cars by 2035. You know, I'm sure there are some households out there that are looking at the gas prices and asking if it's time to trade in their car, get an electric model, but not those lower-income people that get really hit hard by rising prices. And the governor also, you know, he's recently cut back on new oil drilling permits. He doubled down on that last night. He said more drilling is not the solution when there are entire communities burning down in mega fires that are due to climate change.
Well, Assemblymember Flora, who you spoke with, he actually represents San Joaquin and Stanislaus counties, which is portions of the Central Valley. He approached climate change with the mindset of agriculture. What's on top of mind for people who live in rural parts of the state?
Yeah, you know, especially talking about electric and renewable energy, we did ask Assemblymember Flora about that. Here's what he had to say.
It's cost of living issues. It's gas prices. How are we going to put the next meal on the table? It's education. Like, those are the things that we talk about. And it was interesting when he talked about, you know, fuel. Right now, I mean, we're all very supportive of solar and electric vehicles and that whole system. But when it comes to growing food, and this is something that we'd never talk about, especially in the ag world, you don't have tractors that are battery powered right now. The technology doesn't exist. And so if we're going to continue to grow the safest, cheapest food in the world, we're going to have to burn fossil fuels. And there's no better place than to pull fossil fuels out of the ground than California, because we do it the safest, the cleanest, and the most effective anywhere in the world.
You know, drought is also a huge problem for people in, you know, farmers in the Central Valley that Assemblymember Flora represents. And climate change plays a role there, too. There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of debate about the best path forward for drought. But he also talked about how his constituents, you know, polls have shown voters in general have are really concerned about homelessness and crime. Those are sort of lingering issues that could be weak spots for the governor and some legislative Democrats later this
Right.
Here.
Yeah. Well, let's get to homelessness, because that was the sole focal point in his State of the State address back in 2020, weeks before the pandemic and the statewide shutdown. The crisis is only worse. What did he have to say about the issue last night?
Well, you know, like I mentioned, he didn't really, he mostly used the speech to talk about things that he's already proposed or already done. So he talked about what he did to house unsheltered people during the pandemic. Of course, many of these people were at higher risk, you know, living in congregate shelters, or they have underlying health issues. And then the governor also talked up this care court plan he unveiled last week. I think we've got a clip of the governor.
And while we've moved a record 58,000 people off the streets, 58,000 off the streets since the beginning of the pandemic, we all recognize we have more work to do, particularly to address what's happening on our sidewalks, reaching people who need the most help, those with schizophrenia spectrum and psychosis disorders, many self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions. And that's precisely what our encampment resolution grants and our new care court seek to address.
We've heard from some Republicans who kind of shrugged at this a big announcement when the governor made it last week, you know, saying that it either doesn't go far enough or doesn't include enough treatment beds. Assemblymember Flora told us that he's actually excited about it. He sees a lot of potential. So there is room for a possible solution here that could get bipartisan support.
Well, that's promising. Nicole, the backdrop to all of this is the pandemic, and it kind of took a back seat this year. Where did it fit into his address?
Yeah, you know, it was right in the middle. He mentioned it, but didn't spend too much time on it. He definitely defended the strict measures that California has taken throughout the pandemic, you know, with vaccine requirements and schools were closed longer than most other states. He said that the state has a lower death rates than any other large state, which is true. There's a lot of debates out there, though, about, you know, those trade-offs. Depends on who you're talking to again. But he talked about his smarter plan that he unveiled last week, and sort of, you know, that's an option that he's planned.
Yeah. Nicole, thanks for joining us with the highlights. You had a busy night last night.
Thank you. No problem at all.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. Up next, we go 180 and listen to the Republican perspective and explore how progressives within California's Democratic Party are struggling for influence. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. With little to no competition for his job in the upcoming primary and election in November, unless there is a colossal surprise, most Californians and legislators expect Gavin Newsom to breeze to another victory and remain in charge for the next 4 years. But that doesn't mean the Republican Party doesn't have an influence and something to say about his priorities moving forward. Crime, homelessness, the management of the pandemic, not to mention what to do with a massive state surplus, are all top of mind with voters, no matter the party. And here to discuss how the GOP in California is planning on keeping these issues at the forefront of the conversation is Republican political strategist Luis Alvarado. Luis, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for the invitation. A pleasure being with you.
Luis, from a Republican viewpoint, what is the state of California?
Well, the state continues to be in crisis for many, and it's still a paradise for a whole different group. At the end of the day, there's disparity when it comes to who is surviving and who is actually hurting. And as we heard from your commentator, there are people who are expecting the government to come in and help and are not getting the help that they're expecting.
What was your overall impression of the governor's speech? Because the speech obviously painted an optimistic picture. However, critics say he just glossed over a lot of topics and gave little to no specifics.
Well, overall, the sense was that my friend John Meyer at the LA Times that really posed a really good question. Is the speech even worth having at all? Because there was no information. There was no oh, this is something that it's going to change my mind with regards to what the government in California is doing. Let's be honest. The polls throughout California put the governor underwater. He's not being effective. His communication skills are something less than par. And that's going to reflect in the next election. He may feel that he's the Teflon governor because he survived this recall, but it doesn't take away from the facts that his plans are not actually delivering what Californians expect. He talked about the great things that his government has done, but really just, you know, brushed aside the really important things that Californians are caring about. And like you mentioned, homelessness may be one of them, but the number one issue that Californians really care about is crime and the feeling that they're not safe in their homes. And every day we turn the TV on, we see that somebody is suffering from this wave of crime, and they have a sense that the justice system is not responding or is not curtailing that this wave, and that it's going to get worse before it gets better, and the governor has no answer for that.
Well, let's expand upon that, because as a political consultant, you're involved in a lot of polling. You mentioned that crime is the top issue for voters. And obviously, I think that's going to impact the upcoming primary in June and the general in November.
Well, you know, usually it's the economy, right? We heard that the economy is stupid. But when it comes to safety, which usually people feel confident with their law enforcement mechanisms, this is the first time that I see it. It reminds me of the 1980s. When really people didn't feel safe, not only in urban areas, but all across the state. And that is not going to just affect the governor's race. It's going to affect all the other legislators' races. It's going to affect all the other assembly and even congressional races. When the Californians don't feel that the Democratic leaders they have in office right now are responding, and they see that some of their policies, like, you know, Prop 47, are the ones that exacerbated this crime wave of the situation, they're gonna hold them responsible. And I think that triangulates back to what you said earlier, where the progressives feeling that they're being pushed aside, because the progressives' argument really is one of the arguments that hurts Democrats today.
When highlighting the values and the successes here in California, the governor was taking swipes at other states with controversial Republican governors like Texas and Florida. So let's take a quick listen to what he said last night.
Think about this. In December alone, 25% of America's jobs were created right here in California. 1 million new jobs just in the last 12 months. More new business starts during the worst of the pandemic than Texas and Florida combined. But you know what makes us so different than those states, besides the freedom of a woman's right to choose? What makes us different is that as our businesses grow, we don't leave workers behind.
He also took jabs at Texas and Florida again when it came to COVID rates and mask mandates. But what is he trying to accomplish politically when he keeps bringing up those states in comparison?
You know, it reminds me of my little niece when she says, you know, yeah, I may be bad, but look at my sister. She's worse. You know, it doesn't take away that she's bad. It doesn't take away that there are failures in the state of California. It doesn't take away that the governor doesn't have an answer for these problems. And that's a cop-out at the end of the day. You know, Californians are the ones that are hurting. Californians care about him talking about California, not about the rest of the nation. We know the rest of the nation has their problems, and that's why we live here in California, because we want California to be strong. And that's why the governor, I feel, is actually, you know, hiding from the real challenges, the real issues, and there is no answers, and this is the only way he can sidestep the fault for his inactions.
California is overwhelmingly a Democratic majority at the state legislature. Republicans make up about, you know, roughly a quarter of voter registration, and it rivals no party preference. How did the impact of the recall affect or potentially affect the upcoming midterm elections, and what kind of realistic competition is there for the GOP in California?
Well, the GOP is in the California leaders, the elected leaders right now are the probably the most reasonable sounding board to the issues that are facing the constituents in California. They're the ones who are trying to bring common sense and arguments in Sacramento with regards to the bills and propositions, to the issues that are affecting Californians. And it seems that they're working with what you would call, the blue dog Democrats to actually hold some of these policies that are hurting Californians in place. So Republicans have a very strong responsibility, and they're the ones that are trying to ensure that we don't go off the rails into progressive la-la land, like the governor mentioned yesterday. You know, he spilled off his progressive piñata and all the candy he wants to give out. And I think that was just to keep his progressive people in place. But in the reality is that Californians are not going to be happy with what's happening with some other representatives. And they're going to choose reasonable California Republicans to lead in those districts. And I think that is the biggest challenge, the biggest danger that the governor's trying to curtail.
Well, Republicans in California arguably have an identity crisis as well, and fracturing within their own party. And you were on the day after the recall when the governor beat it, and you said Governor Newsom could run for president if he wanted to. Where do you stand on that now?
I still do. I mean, right now he's... He's actually building a resume, a CV that would be accepted because I say that because there's no other Democrat that has national credibility or can actually say that they have a story of success. And California is still the 50th economy of the world. And if there's somebody who would be able to fit into those shoes right now, it's still Gavin Newsom. I don't see anybody else in the Democratic hemisphere being able to say that.
Luis, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that is Republican political strategist Luis Alvarado. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We turn now from a conservative response to the governor's address to the conflicts that Newsom faces within his own party. In recent years, there's been a fracturing of the Democratic Party, an internal tug of war between progressives and centrists over how far left to move the party. The tension was on full display during the California Democratic Party's annual conference just days before the governor's State of the State. CalMatters state government reporter Alexi Kosef joins us with his reporting on this internal party struggle. Alexi, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I'm going to bring the same first question to you. From what you're seeing or hearing, how do you think progressives are reacting to last night's State of the State?
Not well, actually. When the biggest news of the night, the only new policy of the night, is about gas and bringing the cost of gas down, it doesn't really go over that well with people who have made it a big goal to move the state off fossil fuels and put a bigger focus on climate change. I wasn't expecting it, but like the backlash has really been quite huge among that wing of the party. They've sort of denounced this proposal as short-sighted, as regressive, ignoring people, poorer people who might use public transit because they can't afford a car. Obviously, there's still a lot of details from this proposal that need to be worked out and still are forthcoming. But those folks who are really looking at climate change and have made it a priority for themselves are sort of saying that the governor is going down the wrong path with this.
Alexi, given that the Democratic Party has long been the most dominant party in the state, when did you start noticing internal tension within the party?
I think this has always been a factor in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I mean, it's foolish to pretend that political parties haven't always had ideological differences that they're working through around different issues. What we're really noticing right now, though, is that there's an upswing in terms of how vocal the progressive wing of the party is, how ascendant it has been, and its efforts to assert itself. And a lot of people who work in Democratic politics really tie that to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign from 2016 that motivated progressives in a way that nothing had for at least a decade or more. It got a lot of new people into the party who hadn't really been involved with the party politics before. And it created this tension because they were trying to push the party in their direction, and they didn't necessarily have the kind of relationships or experience to work through the system the way it existed. They wanted a different kind of result and a different kind of outcome and a different way of doing things. And so it's not just been an ideological tension. It's also been one of strategy. It's been one of power. There's all kinds of elements wrapped up in this. And it's really changed the dynamics of the California Democratic Party over the last few years.
When it comes to effectiveness, though, for people who identify as progressive, what has happened to that wave from Senator Sanders, you know, back in 2016?
Certainly those people are still around and they are still making noise. But what we've seen is that they have not been able to take over the party and shift it in a new direction the way they wanted. Several times now, they have failed to elect one of their own as a leader of the Democratic Party, and that has really blunted their efforts to change the direction and the strategy of the California Democratic Party. And so what you'll see is a lot of times they'll come forward with a proposal, like recently wanting to ban contributions from a variety of industries that they say aren't aligned with Democratic Party values, including the oil industry, police unions, things like that. And the Democratic leadership, which is maybe a little bit more centrist or a little bit more mainstream in their thinking about how to win elections, sort of beats it back, waters it down, maybe adopts some of it, but not all of it. And so it creates, you know, it creates this frustration among progressive activists who are really wanting big changes. They want to push further and they're not getting as far as they want.
When it comes to the governor and this kind of balancing act that he's doing, I mean, is he essentially kind of to balance between, you know, progressive agendas to energize his base, yet avoiding alienating the centrists that you're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, when you have a party as dominant as the California Democratic Party is in a state, it really becomes a broad tent. And you have a lot of voters who are probably voting for Democrats and aligned with Democrats in California, not necessarily because of any particular ideological connection to the platform or anything like that, but just because that is sort of what politics in California is at this point. And so it requires this very careful balancing and broadly appealing sort of approach to politics to try and keep a coalition like that together. You know, that's why you see something like this gas rebate that the governor has proposed last night, right? Which is really aimed at sort of your average voter who's maybe worried about the pump, you know, what they're paying at the pump, getting to work, all these things like that, and is sort of overlooking the fact that climate change is a really huge part of Democratic politics in California, right? I mean, sometimes you just have to kind of put one thing above the other because the goal that's right in front of you is more pressing. And it just gets complicated to sort of balance all those pieces of what you're trying to do.
Right. Where does the pandemic and even a recall election fit into all of this? I would imagine it was not expected for the governor or his office. Do you think both of these events kind of resulted or sidelined any progressive agenda that they were even thinking about back then?
I think that certainly the legislature continues to, you know, move forward on a lot of it, you know, progressive, you know, a lot of the progressive agenda, and the governor does too. But it's undeniable that for the past 2 years, you know, a lot of things they wanted to get done have been completely sidelined because there's been a pressing crisis in the state that everybody has had to turn their attention to. So, you know, I mean, you can see that even just in the number of bills that people were not able to move forward because they had to sort of take a step back and focus their attention, things like that. I think, you know, as we move out of this, then there is a lot more sort of desire to move quickly and very aggressively on all, some of these things that have been sitting on the sidelines. And so you're seeing a lot of proposals now come forward this year on things like abortion rights, on things like, you know, climate change, on things like voting rights and these things that are a huge you know, a huge ideological, you know, basis for that Democratic identity in California. And people are feeling like they have more room to maneuver this year. And so now it's going to be a question in an election year where people are feeling very uncertain about the state of the world and all of that, whether there's going to be any kind of momentum in the Capitol to actually act on those things.
Alexi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alexi Kosoff is a state government reporter for Cal Matters, sharing his reporting on California's progressive movement and its struggle for influence within the Democratic Party. Still ahead, we'll learn how a crisis of missing Indigenous women in Northern California's Lost Coast is leading to the first database of its kind in the state. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Northern California's Lost Coast spans a rugged, largely remote coastline north of San Francisco towards the Oregon border. In a state of more than 40 million, this region encompassing Humboldt and Mendocino counties is dramatically unobstructed and captivating. It's also where several indigenous tribes have called this place home for millennia. The Yurok tribe is among them. They are grappling with a crisis plaguing indigenous communities across the country. The Associated Press reports that in the past 18 months, five indigenous women have been murdered or gone missing in the Lost Coast, an urgency muted by long reporting problems. Missing and murdered indigenous women are vastly undercounted and largely remain unknown to the general public. But to loved ones in tribal communities, they're human beings neglected by overlaps in a system historically never built to serve them. In response, the Yurok tribe is working to create California's first database for missing indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples. Assisting with this effort is Blythe George, an assistant professor of sociology at UC Merced and member of the Yurok tribe. Blythe, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Excited to have you. Thank you for taking the time. Professor George, you're a member of the Yurok tribe. Can you just describe the area and the surrounding indigenous communities part of this portion of the Lost Coast in Northern California?
Absolutely. I am originally from McKinleyville, California, which is on the coast, very near Eureka, California. Now, these are, right, the points you see on the map now, but it's important to know that the Yurok, the Hoopa, the Karuk, the Wiat, and the Talawa people have called this area home, as you said, for millennia. And so these, you know, these aren't the words we use for it, but the Klamath River, for example, is an area that we've always called home. It's very important to us for stewardship and a variety of, you know, spirituality and meaning making, but it's also many don't realize just how rural this place is, particularly in, you know, California is often thought of as, you know, you're either from San Francisco or LA, and there's actually a whole part of the state way up north, and it's the longest stretch of undeveloped coastline called the Lost Coast in the lower 48. And there's parts of this world and our reservation as the Yurok tribe in particular that I would say is arguably as remote as you can get in the lower 48. So that's a very specific experience for a variety of reasons.
What experiences in your life shaped your career path and the work that you're doing now?
Gosh, thank you for this question. I, you know, as I said, I'm homegrown. I'm from Humboldt, Yurok country. I came from a family where we had experienced some of the adversities that are generally shared by Indigenous peoples at present. You know, a variety of outcomes for Indigenous peoples are often negative, whether it's poverty, unemployment, substance use disorder. All of these were at play in my family history. And so for me, it was important that even though I wanted to pursue higher education, that whatever I did had a way of kind of bringing things back home and impact and intervening in some of those negative trends, because I knew that actually this was a place of great vibrancy and resilience, but that oftentimes we were having to navigate through some really negative adversities in order to access our sacred places and the ceremonies that are meaningful to us.
Yeah. I want to get to the Associated Press because they published a long piece on this crisis that we're going to unpack last month. In it, you revealed in that piece that you knew three of the five women who have gone missing or were murdered. This is very personal for you. What would you like us to know about them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's important for anyone who doesn't come to this matter personally, and perhaps this is the first time learning of it, that they realize that for many in Indian country, the opposite is true, that we are often only one or two people removed from this experience directly, and that the loss to our communities is multi-generational. It is almost incalculable in our data set. And of the women you actually mentioned, most of them were mothers. So that means that the loss of their life is something that will continue to have impacts for generations to come. And we know that that is true both presently and in past tense. And so we have those in our community who have had to carry these burdens for far too long. And unfortunately, more often than not, the lack of justice or really any kind of closure is few and far between. And so we are in a position as tribal people to really have to build a system to meet our needs, because at present, the gaps we are falling through are literally life and death.
Yeah. These women highlight a long epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. You also work with the Sovereign Bodies Institute. What is this nonprofit hoping to accomplish?
Yes. Sovereign Bodies Institute is one of a kind, I would say, when it comes to combining both a survivor-centric victim services approach with very high caliber research and data considerations. Often, you know, an organization might be good at one or the other, but in this issue in particular, we need both. We need to have a grasp of what the data looks like. What do we, you know, I always say we don't know what we don't know, and we can't help to intervene if that's the case. And Sovereign Bodies has an amazingly novel data set in that they don't recognize colonial boundaries. And so they include Indigenous peoples from all tribes, all communities, as well as those from other, across the borders, South America, Mexico, for example.
You mentioned that justice is few and far between. Many of these cases aren't prosecuted. What are you learning? Why is that the case?
So many factors combined, but I think that the biggest one comes down to the multi-jurisdictional nature of many of these crimes, right? Just in the case of Emily Risling, for example, you are having multiple jurisdictions at play, and you have the county jurisdiction, you have tribal police. Many people don't realize that actually in California, we are a public law 280 state, which means that the federal government, you know, in contemporary portrayals, let's say Wind River as a movie, right? The FBI comes in. That's not how things work in California or the other 13 public law 280 states. It's a state matter. And so that means that the state and local law enforcement, in our case, the county law enforcement, they need to be supported and funded and resourced to be able to address these issues. And unfortunately, Public Law 280 came with none of that. And so now oftentimes they may even be vying for the same resources when really it's a case of needing additional resources to meet some really particular needs that by and large rural places across the country and in our state just don't have access to the comparable level of funding they need to meet their unique challenges.
I want to play a clip from the AP piece. This is Abigail Echo Hawk. She is the director of the Urban Health Institute, and she's expanding on what you just talked about.
Particularly in reservations and village areas, there is a maze of jurisdictions, of policies, of procedures, of who investigates what. I worked with a family where for 3 days they couldn't get anybody to investigate the rape because the county, the state, and the tribal police couldn't determine who had jurisdiction.
Blythe, you can hear the frustration in her voice, and at the core of this are people who are seeking out help.
That's what's important about what we're doing for the tribe and the protocols we're trying to produce is that, so at that moment when something happens, when a family needs help, We want the person they call to know what should happen. Even if they don't even know who the right department is to call, there should be the communication in place. There should be the protocols in place, for that's a well-oiled machine and not something that people are, you know, as they say, building the boat as they float, right? And I'm proud to say that in just even the last several years, we have been building this in our home area with the county law enforcement, so that when this call came in, there were certain mechanisms that went into place, even as we continued to learn, because, you know, this project itself was in its third year when we were called upon to have to address a case in real time, and a case that impacted us all so personally. It has been something we navigate daily.
I spoke with Yurok Tribal Police Chief Greg O'Rourke yesterday over the phone, and he told me that the role of a peace officer is to protect the vulnerable, but tribal police are doing this essentially in a system that is broken. He also explained a deeper issue, a historic mistrust of law enforcement and generational trauma that you were touching upon.
Absolutely. And I think that tribal police are in a place to broker so much healing. And I'm happy to say that our tribal police take that as a first order concern, because unfortunately, you know, in our history and in other tribal communities, the police were often, you know, a tool of the state. There was surveillance. They were coming in and they were taking children, right? And so our mistrust goes back across generations. But now we are in a position where those who have to protect us are in police uniforms. And so we, as a tribal body, are trying to really broker that that communication and that trust building, and to provide resources for other tribes and law enforcement agencies who want to engage in that similar effort. Most people don't know that California is in the top five states when it comes to MMIW. So honestly, every law enforcement agency in the state should have a protocol that deals with this and is dialoguing with their tribal partners in their region. And that is not where we are yet, but that's where we hope to be.
Yeah. You talked about Emily Risling, and I think it's just so important to hear from her mother, Judy, who spoke with the Associated Press.
Early on, there should have been a bigger search for her. And I realize it's a very remote area, but, you know, Hoopa police, Yurok police, they're very small. They don't have a lot of help. Every day, the frustration of wanting some, you know, movement to having things getting done, it's very difficult.
She went missing last fall. Is there any update on her case?
Unfortunately, no. After honestly hundreds of search hours, of investigative hours, of a plethora of activity, we aren't any closer to knowing what happened than we were in the fall. And that's hard to sit with, because, you know, we should have had so many things in place. And I think that we need to realize that before we start putting the missing person flyer up, there's so many opportunities where someone could be made safe, where we could have intervened before the unimaginable happens. And I think in this case, you know, there were so many times where we wish mental health services could have intervened, or where the criminal justice system, if they had it in their capacity to facilitate that, would have made sure that happened. And in this case and in others, that doesn't happen. And then you're end up in this place.
Where does the Sheriff's Department fall in this? Because wouldn't this fall under the jurisdiction of Humboldt County?
Yes, so this is a very particular issue, so I want to describe it really well. But essentially, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department is the legal jurisdiction in this part of the world, right? Now, as a tribe that has concurrent jurisdiction under Public Law 280, we have the ability to have our own Yurok police force. Now, at present, unfortunately, this is not recognized through the legislature. And so in order for that tribal police department to be able to enforce state laws on tribal lands, they need to have a agreement in place with the local law enforcement agency. And so oftentimes this takes place through a cross-deputization agreement. There have been other suggestions in other states where tribal police actually are state law enforcement officers themselves, and they don't have to go through that kind of MOU or memorandum of understanding based agreement. But in our part of the world, that is what we've done so that we can address these in real time, even as we push for these kind of higher level solutions. And so at present, the tribal police department has grown and is so effective on tribal lands that they have worked with the county to have jurisdiction over this case. And so they are the agency of record, which is important to acknowledge that even though they are the agency of record, the sheriff is a phone call away. They're in constant dialogue, and that it is because of the extreme trust that they have in tribal police that we're able to serve this capacity.
Yeah. The reality is there are so many cases like this in limbo, and I think it's unrealistic to have a true scope of the problem, but one solution that you are working on is a data set, and it would be a first of its kind in California. Tell us about it. What will it accomplish?
Mm-hmm. Well, the big problem with most databases that are related to missing and murdered, you know, whether it's NAMIS, whether it's, you know, the Center for Missing or Exploited Children, excuse me, these databases, none of them ask about tribal affiliation. And you have to realize that this would almost be like not asking about nationality, that for a tribal affiliation, that's a designation of citizenship. That should be on every form that it's relevant. And in this case, it's, you know, when we know of these epidemics, that should be a question that's asked. We're actually really proud to say that NAMIS has added this in the course of our project, I do believe, in direct response to these kinds of critiques. But in many cases, if you don't have tribal affiliation listed, no one knows to enter it, then the tribes can't be notified. There's no resources that can be mustered for that case. At the same time, though, even if you offer that question, there's also a real chance of racial misclassification, right? If someone's inputting the data, for example, I don't phenotypically present as American Indian. It's highly likely that someone would write me down as white if I were to go missing. And that would mean that I wouldn't be included in, you know, my tribe wouldn't know. And so we have to think of ways to get at this data almost from both angles. And so that's what we try to do, is to make this database, make a template so that other tribes can also start tracking their own data and their own membership, but at the same time, contribute to a larger effort so that we can really get a handle on what this looks like at the regional and state levels.
Yeah. Professor George, before we let you go, we have just about a minute left, but can you tell us more about, and maybe this, the data set falls into this, the I Will See You in a Good Way project, and that on missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, as well as Two-Spirit peoples?
Yes. Now, this is the formal name of the project I've been describing when it comes to the data set and the protocols you know, it was actually on the eve of the pandemic. We earned this grant to try and intervene in this matter. And we had to do so over the course of the last couple of crazy years as we've all lived through. And even still, we have generated two reports, which please go look at Sovereign Body's website. You'll find them there. They are really the best and most exhaustive discussion of what MMIW looks like in the state, with an emphasis on the Northern California region. We are right now in the midst of our third and final report, but this work continues. We are trying to build collaborations across tribes. And so if you hear this today, if you want to know more, please reach out to us. You'll find us on Facebook. And for us, you know, even as we build these tools, these are things we want to share, and you'll actually find resources in those reports. So please think of us as a resource as we try to walk together in a good way and bring our sisters and our relatives back home.
And we have a link to Sovereign Bodies on our Insight page, as well as the Associated Press article, and a link to you, Dr. Blythe George. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for all of your important work. She is an assistant professor of sociology at UC Merced and member of the Yurok tribe. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.